Welcome to On Strategy Showcase. I'm Fergus O'Carroll in Chicago. Here's a clip from today's episode.
You look at like a Vizio, understanding the economics of a hardware company is really important. So for Vizio, let's say they sell a $300 smart TV, which is probably a rough average price for sale. On a $300 smart TV, they make 0.4% margin on that. So they make $1.17 in gross profit for every $300 TV they sell. So very, very low margin product.
Unbelievable.
Now you look at their advertising, right? They make a 62% gross profit, and they make about 3 cents an hour when you watch their SmartCast platform. So they make 3 cents per hour, 62% that's profit versus 0.4% for the TV. So that they make 2 cents of gross profit every hour that you watch on the SmartCast platform. So at 63 hours, once you have watched 63 hours of their SmartCast platform, they have generated more margin than they did from selling the TV.
That's Michael Beach. He's a CEO of Crossscreen Media. I actually discovered him through what I think is an amazing newsletter, State of the Screens. It's one of those newsletters that has the perfect amount of detail to get you smart really quick. And the perfect amount of detail is the smallest amount of detail possible. He does a brilliant job of giving you the specifics, breaking down what's happening in the streaming category, and giving you revenue numbers, giving you volume numbers, giving you inside stories. And it's something that you can consume within 2 minutes. And I love it. Now, they're not a sponsor of the show, by the way. I'm just a fan of their work. And if you want to learn how to subscribe to their newsletter, we actually discuss that towards the end of the episode. So we're going to be talking today about the streaming landscape and the traditional media bundle. So much is changing in recent years in terms of consolidation, in terms of content offerings, in terms of brands and brand strategy, and pricing strategy, which is a huge part of it. Yet brand and brand attribution, in my opinion, remains very fuzzy. And overall, though, I'm a huge fan. For those of you who have heard my Tubi episode or my Amazon Prime episode, you can tell that I'm pretty much a fanatic about this space. And I don't even know why I love it so much, but there's so many shifts and changes happening that it's like a game trying to keep track of which brands have got which properties and what pricing tier is happening and what pricing tier is changing. So anyway, Michael is brilliant at this. And I'd say just grab a coffee and settle in. Next week, we're going to be back with episode number 2 of our Startups, Scale-Ups, and Grown-Ups series, which is sponsored by Tracksuit, the affordable brand tracking platform for modern day brands. Last week, our focus was on startups in episode 1. Next week, we come back with scale-ups and with a whole new set of guests. So I'm really excited about that. Until then, however, here is my conversation with Michael Beach on the streaming landscape. And by the way, Walmart did in fact agree to buy Vizio this week for $2.3 billion. So clutch your pearls, everyone. Awesome changes just keep coming. Enjoy. So I'm super curious to have your point of view on how you would describe the streaming landscape today.
Oh, that's a great question. And it's complicated. On the one hand, almost every number is going up. And I'll get into kind of the one key number that's kind of making this complicated. But, you look up in the last year, time spent with streaming is up 9%, really at the expense of linear TV. Ad spend is up 25%. That's not necessarily at the expense of linear TV. That linear TV is, declining very slowly, but has mainly held their spend. And so that's new dollars coming into the market with new advertisers or new use cases. The one number that is not going in the right direction is profitability. And, I'm sure we'll get into this a little more later in the show, but that is actually going to have probably in the near term, the next, 1 to 3 years, the biggest impact on everything, because a lot of these companies that have entered this space and offered all this content have been doing so at a large loss. And that is going to change.
And so what are we talking about here in terms of change? Is it going to change in terms of what the offering is or what the cost is going to be?
Probably a little bit of both and maybe some alternatives, but at a high level, you've got the linear bundle, which is one of the best business models, you know, we've ever seen, right? Recurring revenue, very low churn. It's funded all this great content that we've liked over the years, sports. I mean, it's really impacted every area of our life, from news, how we get what news we get and where we get it, to, you know, how much your local baseball team can afford to pay a free agent. It's all been really driven by our media model here in the U.S.
And it's a dual revenue model stream, right? Because you have to both pay for your subscription, plus it's ad supported.
Yeah, exactly. And the subscription part is probably the most important in there, just because that allowed these media companies to have a high confidence of a revenue stream into the future that they were going to get. People canceled at really low rates. So you had, you know, low churn. And they were able to just continuously raise prices faster than people canceled, so that the pie continued to grow. And we're kind of seeing where that has peaked. And in its place is this streaming model where you've got a ton of competition, you've got low barriers to entry, so many more people are in the market. And everyone has to fight that battle. They have spent a lot of money on competition. So you got people, you know, spending $30 million on an hour long episode of a TV show.
Yeah.
And then they're losing money to gain market share. So they've acted like a technology company would, but with completely different economics.
The model behind that is obviously to secure subscribers, secure a level of loyalty, and in terms of people that are subscribing month over month. And then I've got to assume that is done with the expectation of what we're seeing, which is ultimately over time, you're going to go from a $9.99 subscription to Netflix that's now $22 without ads. Is that a corner that we can expect to see turn for everybody, where we're going to have to get back to a more realistic a subscription dollar amounts, which unfortunately starts to smell and stink very much like the entire system that we were trying to escape, which was, you know, the $60, $80, $150 package. But in essence, is that what we can expect to be done in addition to some ad-supported tiers?
Yeah, I mean, there's some combination of that is going to happen for sure. And I think with the linear bundle, basically, we all jumped into the same thing. And yes, there were premium networks like HBO or Showtime that didn't carry ads. But for, you know, 80% plus percent of the time that we were on linear, we would get at, you know, everybody, right? The you know, the wealthiest family in your area and the, you know, lowest income family all saw roughly the same amount of ads. But what you're seeing now in streaming, and whether this survives or not into the future, is that these companies now are rapidly raising prices on their ad-free plans, because they can do a little bit of price discrimination, right? Like, they can offer one package to one group of people and another package to another group. And so you're seeing a rapid increase in the price for the ad-free plans. They're making the ad-supported plan more attractive because they actually make more money per user on those ad-supported plans.
Interesting.
And I do think that's a trend that will continue and could really accelerate in the future, to kind of depending on the market shakes out. But what it's doing is, for an advertiser, is you're starting to see where your reach to higher income people is going to be harder in the future. And that we've never really dealt with, right? Like, if we watched, you know, a sitcom on ABC, you saw ads. Maybe you were able to adopt a DVR faster, you know, when TiVo came out, than another family. But for the most part, you know, advertisers were able to reach everybody. And I think you're going to see a big spread in the next, you know, 3 to 5 years, where when you dig into your reach numbers, you know, a number that stands out is probably income level is going to be harder to reach people, because they're going to pay up for these ad-free plans.
Last night, I was just sort of preparing for this morning's recording, and I tried to sort of map out all of these platforms, or at least many of them that are in the marketplace right now. And it was really difficult. It's becoming increasingly difficult to know which content, which brands are behind which platforms, and how things are changing. I mean, the obvious ones are the Netflix and the Amazon Primes, and I mean, Hulu, in terms of its ownership or its shared ownership, has dramatically changed in the last number of years. Paramount Plus, the portfolios that are behind all of these brands, and then the ongoing mergers, the recent conversations, I believe it's with Paramount Plus and with Max and Warner Brothers Discovery, they're in conversations about possibly merging also. So everything is shifting and changing and consolidating. What does this begin to look like? Is there just not the possibility of many of these surviving independently, and there's got to be increased consolidation? And then what does that mean for advertisers and for consumers?
You've got, you know, in one end at the highest level right now, you've got a company like Netflix, which is a pure play streamer, and they are profitable. And so they are kind of one off by themselves to where no other pure play streamer is profitable or has survived. You've got a number of traditional companies, you name several of those, you know, the Disneys and the Paramounts, the Warner Brothers, that are have a profitable linear business that's slowly, you know, starting to disappear, but they're taking cash flow from that and investing it in these streaming entities that are still losing a lot of money. I mean, billions of dollars a year. You know, what that looks like is the million-dollar question, right? And we have a framework, you know, we call it the rule of 100, and it's broken up into five pieces. And really the way to look at it is in the future, probably, you know, 5 years out or so, you know, number one, you know, 100% of TV will be streamed in probably a decade, right? Like once the NFL, current NFL contract runs out, we could see a scenario where close to 100% of your TV is streamed. And then number two, when that happens, 100% of your TV advertising will be streamed just by definition. The third component is that the advertiser base will be 100 times the size it is of what national TV's advertiser base is today. And why that's important is that today you've got this really bifurcated ad market where you've got the majority of television inventory is sold to national advertisers. You know, a lot of it's cleared at events like the upfronts, and you know, we read about Super Bowl advertising. But the long tail advertisers, the, you know, 99% of the advertisers are in either digital only or buy local TV today, and they are not able to buy that inventory. But in the future, you've got technology to where a Paramount or a Hulu could sell the same impression of an ad to Procter & Gamble, or they could sell to the local car dealership. And that doesn't exist today, but when that happens, you're going to see pricing dynamics like you've seen on Facebook and YouTube. You know, it surprised a lot of people that the most expensive CPMs that we see people put on their media plan are usually on Facebook for video, even though it's this little ad and it has very low attention. And that's not a component of value. It's the fact that they have at least 3 million advertisers in the U.S. in an auction every day, and no other video seller has anything like that. Maybe they have 10 people bidding against the same inventory. And so when you have 100 times the advertiser base, you're going to see you know, a lot of increased competition, which leads to the fourth component, which is $100 CPMs. And this is probably the one number that people disagree with the most. But when advertisers, especially that long tail, really understand their audience, they are willing to pay a lot more to reach that person than they would if they were just buying a bucket that inside that bucket, that spot, maybe had some of their customers. And again, this is the same pricing dynamics you see on Facebook and YouTube. And then the number five, which is here today almost, is we're going to have $100 billion TV ad market. And we're in the 90s already. So this is probably the first thing that will hit when you put streaming and linear together. Why that last one's important is that the market's going to grow, but they're going to be completely different winners, right? Like Netflix 10 years ago wasn't a player, or even 2 years ago, in that $100 billion market. And now they're going to have a major seat at the table, which means that somebody that is a major player today is going to be gone or have a diminished role. And that is probably the million-dollar question, is that we think the market's going to grow. It's going to shift from linear to streaming, but it's not necessarily going to be the same winners. You know, we're going to have YouTubes and Netflixes and people like that having a major seat, which has got to come from somebody else.
So it seems like most of the brands are beginning to play with a mixed revenue model. So it's ad-supported plus it's subscription-based. Are there any brands that are different in terms of their play? For example, Apple. I look at Apple as a platform, and I struggle to find where that fits into the big picture. I struggle to find distinct identities that many of these brands have. Is it clearer to you when you look at Apple v. Disney versus Paramount, Hulu, Amazon Prime? I mean, when you look at Peacock, what are some of the propositions that you think are unique from these platforms compared to each other?
Well, yeah, I mean, so like Apple's a perfect example, right? Like they are putting up billions of dollars of content spend. They are not making anywhere near that money back. And so if you looked at from the economics of just, you know, the Apple TV Plus streaming service, it wouldn't make sense. But I'm sure somewhere there they've got, hey, you know, if we can keep people on the iPhone or move them to a overall services bundle, you know, in the long term will make sense. And, you know, as much as I don't understand their play in TV, you know, I have to give them credit for being like the most successful capitalist on earth right now. You know, they're going to figure it out. But the interesting thing is when you're locked into this huge content spend up front, which like if you're a Peacock or something like that, you've got tens of billions of dollars of commitments up front, sports and scripted shows and news. So you're kind of locked into a model you've got to get into. The really interesting thing is that you look at a platform like YouTube, where they don't have any content costs at all up front. And they pay out purely on a rev share on the back end. So they end up paying billions of dollars for content, but it's not risked up front. And so they're able to evolve a totally different market. And you're seeing this with TikTok, you're seeing this with Facebook. And so again, those are not people I would put on the TV media plan today, but that model is really interesting because it's the most profitable video model that's out there right now. We look at it like a totally separate bucket, but you know, I always look at, is there a way to recreate any of that in a traditional TV market? And I'll give you another example. My kids watch, you know, Mr. Beast on YouTube all the time. And for anyone who hasn't gone in, this is like a phenomenon, like probably the most popular non-sports TV show out there is anytime Mr. Beast puts a video out, you know, once every week or a couple weeks. And so I tell my kids, you're watching too much YouTube, right? Like no more YouTube. So then they go on into Roku and find a fast channel that Mr. Beast has his own fast channel. And they're watching this. And so it's literally set up like a TV network, but it's just of user-generated content from that was originally put on YouTube. And to my kids, that is a linear TV feed of shows. And so, you know, you think about the economics. Did that fast channel have to pay up front for that? Did they just guarantee ad sales? Is it a rev share back? There are a lot of different models that come from that side that you could adopt in what we call the TV world today to kind of de-risk some of these investments. And we haven't seen that yet because it's been, you know, who can afford to pay for the NFL or who can afford to pay, you know, for the Lord of the Rings show. But there is an alternate model that is actually a lot more profitable.
And when you look at, I think recently it was announced that Twitter, now X, and TikTok, I think it was talked about in the context of Twitter, that they're now exploring longer format shows on Twitter that would be rev shares with personalities who have either been or are on recognized personalities and celebrities. That's a kind of a new way of beginning to look at how X and how possibly TikTok might evolve over time.
Oh, for sure. And you think about it, you know, you've seen this in publishing where, you know, the upstart, you know, person goes to the traditional publisher and builds a name for themselves. And then when they start to get to where they are a star, which traditionally would have been the time that the publisher would have profited the most from that person, the investment they made, that person leaves and starts a Substack or their own, or they leave to start Politico or Axios. And then the profits go there, right? And you're seeing that in music now. Now you start to see that on video to where, yeah, if you're a news personality, you know, as the ability to pay these people less every year to be on the 8 p.m. primetime slot, you know, lowers, they're now incentivized to leave and do their own thing on a, you know, a platform like X or somewhere else. So just an interesting dynamic because you would lose the profit center because the traditional company has made the investment to build this brand, but now the brand has the ability to go out and, you know, directly sell to the consumers. It's really interesting. I think that is going to come to television, some format, probably news first, which is, I think, we're already seeing.
And which brings up the question of brand versus program and content. So, for example, when I look at this list, it's actually stuck up in front of me here. I look at Disney. I look at HBO. I look at ESPN. And I maybe look at Fubo. And I can go, okay, I know what those brands are about. I can imagine what is in those buckets in terms of content. It's very clear to me. And so I would be quite intentional if I was subscribing to those. If I look at the others, Paramount Plus, Hulu, Amazon Prime, Netflix, Peacock, or maybe less with Peacock, and others, it's unclear to me what exactly I can or should expect. In other words, I don't think there's clarity in those brands. And I worry that the danger is that we just chase shows and that we end up in the way things used to be, where you watched NBC for one show and then you went back to CBS for another. And so there wasn't loyalty to a brand or a clarity of brand, but there was loyalty and interest in watching shows. And then within the world of shows without brand, attribution becomes a problem because there's an awful lot of content out there and many people don't know exactly which platform they're watching it on. Is that something that you think can be a challenge ultimately, that if there isn't clarity in what the proposition of the platform is, that could be dangerous long term?
It could definitely be dangerous long term, but I think it probably feeds another trend, which is just who's going to aggregate all this, right? So, back to the pay TV bundle, amazing, you hit one input on your TV and you've got access to all this content. Kind of always amazed me that the cable companies, even as they came out with kind of more advanced interfaces, didn't do a more aggressive job to try to recommend content to you or to try to filter out the programming. And I'm sure they had some kind of dynamic where that would have upset the people that were paying them, their network partners. But that was an area, as you start, you go on Netflix and you're getting a curated feed, and then you went into, Xfinity, which is a, fantastic, interface for kind of with linear, why they weren't, I'm not getting the same recommendations there. And so I think that was a missed opportunity. So if you look at streaming now, we are overwhelmed by the number of apps all this content is in, to your point where you've got to remember to go into Peacock to watch this show or go into Paramount Plus, not even just to watch Yellowstone, right? Like you got to have a piece of paper to remember which app has spinoff versus the original. And so you see the hardware companies are trying to play a gatekeeper role where they are, I'm Roku or I'm Vizio or I'm Samsung and I see everything you're watching. I can make recommendations for you and I can curate a feed for you. The apps themselves obviously don't like that because it turns them into a commodity. But I think that's an interesting dynamic because how we discover content in the future is really going to change. And I think looking at what's going on with YouTube and TikTok and Facebook with these, algorithm driven feeds is interesting because I don't know that we're ever going to go that far with TV, but it's going to be way more in that direction than probably people are accustomed to. And then who has the power in that position is interesting. Because then also that same company could dictate the advertising as well.
We'll be right back.
One of the things that makes this
the most effective advertising campaign in the world
so effective is the use of brand purpose. Here at the Master of Advertising Effectiveness, our purpose is to improve the effectiveness of advertising so that underprivileged children can grow up on a healthier planet. To join our movement and learn more about what really makes advertising effective, head over to mae.academy. That's mae.academy.
Now back to the show. I was reading a Wark newsletter this morning, and you're probably familiar with this too, which is that Walmart is now in talks to buy Vizio, which is the manufacturer of televisions and device or TV devices. And it's the idea of this sort of fusion of retail media with connected television. The fact that many of these brands, in terms of their retail media, they're beginning to move upstream or up the funnel rather than just doing a lower funnel type work. So retail media is moving up the funnel away from simply search formats. And to see a retailer now buying an installed base of Vizios, as well as being able to sell, to be baked in to the TV set that you buy for your home, is a pretty amazing step, right? I mean, some of this is already going on with Roku and with Amazon Fire TV, but this is like a major step and a major shift in market share if Walmart actually does this acquisition.
Oh, you're completely right. I mean, you can look at it from the retailer now, how much money they make from selling you products to the data that is generated from selling those products to now being an advertising business. Obviously, you've seen the shift with Amazon the last couple of years. But you look at like a Vizio, understanding the economics of a hardware company is really important. So for Vizio, let's say they sell a $300 smart TV, which is probably a rough average price for sale. on a $300 smart TV, they make 0.4% margin on that. So they make $1.17 in gross profit for every $300 TV they sell. So very, very low margin product.
Unbelievable.
Now you look at their advertising, right? They make a 62% gross profit and they make about 3 cents an hour when you watch their SmartCast platform. So they make 3 cents per hour, 62% that's profit versus 0.4% for the TV. So that they make 2 cents of gross profit every hour that you watch on the SmartCast platform. So at 63 hours, once you have watched 63 hours of their SmartCast platform, they have generated more margin than they did from selling the TV. So the average SmartCast household watches 21 hours a week of that thing. So they can, within 3 weeks of a normal household, they actually make more margin from advertising than they do from selling you the TV.
You know, it's interesting because one thing that was announced recently was this idea of a new sports platform separate from ESPN that was going to be a joint venture between Fox and Disney's ESPN, Warner Brothers, and all of their content for sports content. Is this part of what we're going to be seeing here? Again, it's just like that play is confusing to me. Do you understand that? I mean, it seemed to me back in the early days of Hulu when ABC and CBS and NBC were joint partners in that very early on, that sort of made sense from a joint content play. But then they've all started to reverse that. They're now taking their content and putting it on their own independent platforms. But then we see this one announced last week as a sports platform. What's behind that? Do you have any opinion of what's behind this idea of a shared model as a sports platform?
Well, it's really interesting because on the surface, I think there are areas of it that make a lot of sense. And I'll kind of get to those in a second. The thing I think it's really important to understand, especially Hulu is a good example, is that the people that assume this is a game changer assume that everyone is going to cooperate and it's going to be an efficient execution of the plan, right? And that with Hulu has not traditionally been like Hollywood's, their playbook, right? Because for this to work, it would have to go pretty smooth. You've got, scenario where people are like, well, this is going to cost roughly $40 a month for all the sports rights. And then on the surface, you'd say, okay, well, if I'm the most dominant group in the bundles still are people that watch tons of linear TV and then people that watch sports, a lot of sports. And so that next group of people that have not cut the cord because it's the only way to access sports, well, you could say, well, I can pay this group $40 and then pay, Netflix and a couple people $20 a month and get all my content needs for $60, cancel my, $100 to $150 a month cable package. That's like the kind of the simple scenario there. But for the people putting this bundle together, if they price this thing too close to what they're paid a la carte by the cable company, then that's going to upset the cable company. And you've kind of already seen the Charters and Comcast sort of make noise here where they could drop these sports networks from the base packages. So think about every household in the United States that has cable pays ESPN $10 a month. So ESPN makes, roughly $700 million a month from every month in recurring revenue from the cable TV packages. Mm-hmm. If they got booted out of that and got put into the additional tier where you got to pay $15 a month, you'd probably only have about 3% of households would opt in. That's roughly what percent of people watch ESPN on a regular basis. And that all of a sudden revenue stream would go from $700 million a month to, let's say, $200 million a month overnight. And so there's a delicate balancing act here because if a package like this did succeed, it could hasten the demise of the traditional bundle. But the people that are going to lose there could also really impact those networks. And so that is the part I have trouble understanding how this thing is actually going to succeed, because they would have to get everything right for it to go. But and then also on the other end, you've got people coming together now that are traditionally bidding against each other for sports rights. And so the leagues are not necessarily incentivized in the short term for this to succeed, because they are going to lose at least one of their, say, three or four bidders, which is not going to have a positive impact on their ability to to raise media rights. If we're on this iceberg that's slowly melting, our content costs are still rising faster than we can raise our monthly price. And so, you know, they've got to figure out a way to get more subscribers into the system. And again, you know, if you read a lot of the trades, it's like sports rights are like the unstoppable kind of Goliath. But I actually kind of disagree there. I've always thought sports were the kind of linchpin of the economic model here. And I think there's more uncertainty than people lead on. Like if you look at baseball, the last 3 or 4 years, every year now, you go into spring training and there are major free agents that have not signed. And people are like, why is this happening? Why is this happening? Well, it's happening because these teams make so much money from their local media rights. And that is very uncertain right now. And that's probably the first thing. And if you would ask someone 10 years ago, like, what's the first thing for sports that's going to go bankrupt? They would have said it's the regional sports networks and the way these rights, because again, everybody in America pays for it. They keep raising the rate every month where, you know, it was 60 cents. And then all of a sudden it's $6 a month for everybody. And they only get a fraction of the people that even watch, you know, ESPN or anything to watch it. You knew that was going to be the problem, right? But the baseball teams kept getting higher media rights fees, which then drove the franchise values up. So then they sold to the next group of people. And then the franchise was worth $1 billion instead of a few $100 million. And that was driven by local media rights. Well, now that is very uncertain. Like there were teams last year that took a 15 or 20% haircut mid-year because they got dropped by, you know, Bally Sports. There are teams that everyone's on a one-year deal this year where they don't have any certainty in what their revenue is going to be 2 years from now. And so outside of like the Dodgers, who have the best TV deal ever, and it's well into the future, who just signed, you know, $1 billion of free agents, everybody else is really uncertain. And I think that is, you'll see that in the NFL last, but you're going to see, you know, Major League Baseball was probably the first to get hit. The NFL is the last, but every other league in the middle and network is next here, because they've got to figure out how to be able to monetize this. And they can't do that yet on streaming. Like the economics don't work there. And so ESPN, to your point, is trying to figure out, well, how can I keep this $700 million a month revenue stream from linear, but then add to it so that 10 years from now, you know, we've got $1 billion a month revenue stream coming in, even if it's majority streaming. But they can't go all in on streaming yet because they couldn't afford to miss out on the recurring revenue monthly.
So what do you think is going to happen with this sort of behavior that really, I think, made Netflix and other platforms heroic, which was this idea of releasing entire seasons at once where we could binge that content? Are we sort of, and I mean, I see a lot now, I think we're all seeing it to varying degrees, that we're seeing far more shows come out with weekly episode releases. Has the insanity of full season releases on the same date, is that coming to an end? Is that past now? Do you see that? I mean, it just seemed to me to be completely unsustainable to be able to do that.
Yes and no. So the way I would look at this is that the majority of the data that I've seen says that it's better to, for a variety of metrics, including churn, to release on a week-by-week schedule, similar to how we've watched TV in the past. So I think that the people that have done that are probably going to stick with that in the future. Where it flips is that if you're a player like a Netflix that actually generates the most content and you've got the best data on what your people like, and you feel like you can constantly be giving them a feed of new content, you're actually probably incentivized to go against that because the customer likes it. And that is an ability for you to have a competitive advantage over. So whereas like Disney Plus, that produces a very small number of high quality shows, they couldn't run the binge model even if they wanted to, even if the data said that was the right thing to do, because they don't have enough content to even like sustain it. Whereas Netflix can sustain it. It'll be interesting. Like I think you'll probably see two worlds on that still. And you might see how, like what Netflix did with, a couple of those shows where they released them in two or three batches throughout the season.
Yes. Isn't the next thing going to be, well, how do we begin? It already is. How do we begin to reduce our content production costs if you're Netflix? And is the binging, is it really necessary in order to keep that subscriber?
Well, yeah, Netflix, and this obviously changed a little bit a couple of weeks ago with their kind of foray into wrestling, live programming. But for the most part, they are spending all of their content budget on you know, programming that is not timeless, but more evergreen, right? Whereas if you are a company, you're spending a lot of money on the NFL, that has all its value on the day it airs and kind of goes away. So Netflix is probably going to end up with the largest library of content for the next couple of years. And then another thing has happened where, since they are the only profitable player, other companies, you know, Warner Brothers, Disney, are now licensing their content to Netflix. You know, think about Suits and all these shows that Netflix has got a really high likelihood that they know that they could get their audience to binge that. They can pay more than anybody else because of their positive economics. They're the only profitable streamer. And so you're going to have a flywheel here where, as these traditional companies are desperate to reduce their streaming losses, they're going to license more content to Netflix of shows that everyone already knows are a success.
Yes.
Which is then going to give Netflix more content to then let people binge, because it might take them a few weeks to binge Suits, but then they're going to have another show right after that. And so that's where I think you could see a difference, because they are just in a different position than everybody else.
And that's a great point, because the reason that Suits and those types of shows have been licensed to Netflix is because the platforms themselves, the people who actually own that content, they're licensing that out because they're completely unprofitable as platforms. It's a weakness.
Exactly. I mean, they're basically giving the tool to their competition that is just going to strengthen their position. But they don't really have a choice right now. And, you know, there's a lot of debate about, did these companies wait too long to enter the streaming market? Should they have stopped licensing content to Netflix back in, you know, 2016, 17, 18, 19, earlier than they did? But they're in the position now to where that losing all this money into the futures, I mean, Wall Street alone won't allow that to happen. So it's an unsustainable position. But yeah, then they're licensing the gold back to, you know, you're going to have HBO shows on Netflix, right? And Netflix is going to crush that because they've got the best understanding of their audience of any company in the world. And now they've got the best content that they're getting from other people.
One or two last things before we wrap up. What is the reality in the world of streaming and cable? Like, what are the numbers? Is traditional cable tanking? Or is that being overly dramatic? Is there still do they still have more viewers than many of the other platforms? How does it look?
Well, it's complicated. So if you look at just on viewers, you have more households in the U.S. have Netflix than have a pay TV bundle. Now they're paying, you know, $15 or less per month for Netflix, or paying $100 more for cable. So it's not anywhere near the business that you have today. Netflix releases their numbers where they combine US and Canada together. Traditionally, when they have broken those out, the US has been about 90% of that mix. So if you kind of held that together now, they would have about 75 million households in the US would have Netflix. And so cable, you've dipped, if you include the streaming packages, you've dipped somewhere around 70 to 72 million. There is some duplication in that. Like I have Charter and I have YouTube TV. So, and I count twice in there, but that's probably a very small use case. So at max, they've got about 72 million households. So Netflix is in 3 million more. Disney Plus is probably close getting up there, but they're a much lower monthly cost. So that's, you've crossed that line to where they have more reach. Netflix has only got, you know, 3% of their subscribers have ad supported plan versus, you know, 100% of cable people aren't ad supported. Cable's got 16 minutes an hour of ads. Netflix has got 4. So the ad business is dramatically smaller. So for an advertiser, the reach in the bundle is way higher today than Netflix. So that's why it's kind of complicated to look at. But then Netflix has the most scale of anybody. So when you go below that, it gets even murkier because, you know, in reality, like Peacock has the most ad-supported, or Hulu and Peacock have the most ad-supported households in the U.S. of any streamer. And that's more of a function of the fact that the majority of their subscribers are ad-supported.
Yeah.
And so even though they have a much lower household penetration than Netflix, they've got 60 to 70% of subscribers are on an ad plan. So they actually have got the best ad business today to look at.
And is it still the case that Netflix is seeing most of its growth and the vast majority of its subscribers are outside the US, right?
Yeah. So they have 260 million households total at the end of last year, and about 75 million of those are in the US. So the U.S. is the most profitable customers, like it is for any media company, but they're definitely the minority of the total subscriber base for Netflix globally.
So last question would be, give us two key things to look out for this year and next year. What do you think are the two most important things that might happen or will happen?
I think one's obvious, it's kind of already happening, but these ad-free plans are going to get, they're going to get crazy expensive. And so, you know, I try to think through what the ceiling is for this, and I really can't come up with the number, but you know, you're going to have, you know, maybe an ad-free plan that's $20 and an ad-supported plan is $6 or $7. And I kind of get there just about doing the math on how much ad revenue these companies make from the ad-supported plans. And so I think that's one thing that's going to shock people. I don't know that, you know, I think at some point you're going to get to a group of people that just aren't price-sensitive at all. They just don't want to see advertising, which is what we talked about earlier. And they're just going to, you're going to lose those people in the TV ad market. And the second one is sports and news going to streaming. And this is sports is happening first, which is kind of surprising to me. You know, you saw the playoff game with Peacock, you got Thursday Night Football. Those have definitely succeeded this year. I don't know if they were financially worth what they're being paid for this year, but you could see a path where as they grow in the future, they're going to be good businesses. No one has replicated quality news on streaming yet. You know, CNN Plus didn't really get off the ground. You got Fox Nation, which is not their actual, you know, live programming. You've got some streaming only companies, but it's usually lower quality. That is, I think, really interesting because news is underpaid in the bundle versus the amount of time it takes up. And so I've always thought that it could be successful on streaming. You just haven't seen it. But when you have news and sports on streaming, you're going to have a whole new group of people that can cut the cord because that's the only reason they are still paying the bundle. They may end up, to your point earlier, paying $100 a few years from now to somebody else per month. Like it might not be a cost savings, but in the short term, you know, I think you're going to see more people go that way.
It is Michael Beach, CEO of Cross Screen Media in Washington, D.C., Baltimore area. And his newsletter, if you haven't subscribed to this, please do. It's a brilliant read. I love it, Michael. It's what brought me to you in the first place. It's snippets of useful content sent to your inbox. It's State of the Screens. You can go to crossscreen.media, right? Isn't it?
Yes.
Crossscreen.media. And if you go under the Insights tab, you can subscribe to State of the Screens. Michael, man, this was just a great conversation. You're a smart dude, and I would love to have you come back on in the future. Thank you for your time.
Oh, anytime. I'm grateful for the opportunity.
And we will see everybody on the next episode.